Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Samuel Gregg joining us. He is the research director at the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's a prolific writer. He got his DPhil at the University of Oxford. His previous books include For God and Profit, How Banking and Finance Serve the Common Good, and also a little book called Becoming Europe. But today, a different topic is a new book that Sam has just published. It's a book with Renyery. It is titled Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. So Samuel, thanks for joining us.
Mark, it's a pleasure to be with you and your First Things listeners.
Well, you know, this is a lovely book. I have that's a nice dust jacket that they did.
They do a good job
for the cover. Yes, indeed. The book. Okay, the struggle for Western civilization. Now let's just jump right into the book. You begin with a speech that Pope Benedict delivered in September 2006, and in your opinion, this book was explosive. This speech was explosive. You actually say, returning to his old university on September 12th, 2006, Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict the 16th, delivered a lecture bearing the seemingly harmless title, Faith, Reason, and the University, Memories and Reflections, delivered to old friends and the Regensburg faculty. And then you say, hours later, the world exploded. What happened? What was it about this little speech whose title has given you something of your title, I see?
Well, I remember very well that speech, as I suspect many First Things listeners do. And the reason we remember that speech, at least initially, is because of the reaction from within the Muslim world. There was a lot of strong words were said. There were occasional outbursts of violence. And there were some deaths as a result of this in the Islamic world inflicted upon Christians. But while that was clearly what struck most people at the time, I remember reading the speech very carefully, maybe a day later, and I realized to myself, well, on one level, this speech is clearly about Islam and some questions which need to be asked about Islam and its relationship to questions of faith and reason. But more fundamentally, you read the text very carefully and you realize Islam is in some respects a secondary issue. The speech is really about us. It's about the West. It's about what's happened to the West, the origins of the West, the place of religion in the history and culture of the West, and what the place of reason and religion are in the culture of the West more generally. And one of the things I try to argue in this book is that if you want to understand what I'm generically calling the West, if you want to understand a civilization that has taken things like liberty, rule of law, creativity, justice, etc., very seriously, and has developed particular notions of what these things mean, you need to understand the particular integration of reason and faith that has happened in the West and the breakdown of that integration over a period of time. Now, all civilizations, I think, all cultures at some level deal with this relationship between reason and faith. It's not as if the West is the only society, the only culture that does this. But the West does it in a particular way, so much so that I think that once that particular way of integrating reason and faith starts to fade or starts to weaken, or starts to be neglected, which I think is often more the case, then something about the West itself is bound to change. And I think it produces what I call in the book, after Benedict XVI, Joseph Ratzinger, pathologies of reason and faith. And a pathology, of course, is a type of sickness. And one of the things that happens, I think, when the particular relationship that took a long time to develop in the West between reason and faith starts to disintegrate, we are confronted with different pathologies, pathologies of reason, pathologies of faith. A pathology of reason would be something like scientism, the reduction of reason to the natural sciences. A pathology of faith, in a way, would be Marxism. Marxism, as I argue in the book, has many of the characteristics of a pseudo-religion. It has sacred books, it has prophets, it has heroic saint-like figures, it has an ecclesiology, it has a hierarchy, the Communist Party, and we know...
It has a teleology.
Absolutely, absolutely. It has a whole vision of what the world is supposed to become and a whole understanding of what that means for the nature of human persons. So my argument is that if you want to understand particularly the terrible 20th century that many of us experienced at different levels, you need to understand that this relationship between reason and faith that the West forged and its breakdown throughout much of the 19th century and into the 20th century helps to explain some of those things. I don't claim that this is the one thing that explains everything about the West and what's happened to it. But I do think it's a factor that needs much more attention if we're trying to understand where the West has come from, what's happened to the West, but also what are some of likely scenarios that might play out in the future.
You summarize the challenge that Benedict presented to us with this sentence. Do you? These are sort of your paraphrase.
Yes.
Of Benedict's question. Do you, meaning us here in the West, do you understand that unless the West gets the relation between reason and faith right, it will be unable to overcome its inner traumas or defend itself from those who wage war against it in the name of particular ideologies? So the word trauma is certainly parallels the pathology side of things. And let me give a sentence that appears a couple paragraphs later, which lays out much of the substance of the book. I want to show how the expression and makeover of different ideas about reason and faith by such figures as Plato, the Hebrew prophets, the Apostle Paul, Thomas Aquinas, Karl Marx, John Stuart Mill, and Friedrich Nietzsche have contributed to civilizational growth but also regression in the West. There's the pathology again at the end, right?
Yes.
And this is much of the argument of the book, running through these clarifications, expositions, developments in the relationship of reason and faith through the great Western thinkers.
Yes, because one of the things I try and do is pull out representative figures in the history of, let's call it the history of ideas, which I guess is partly what the book is about. And I try and read particular figures, and let's talk about some of the people who I associate with some of the pathologies. So someone like John Stuart Mill or Karl Marx or Friedrich Nietzsche. Now, all three men had interesting religious backgrounds. Nietzsche's father was a Lutheran pastor. Nietzsche studied theology before he decided that God didn't exist. Karl Marx's father and mother, for that matter, came from rabbinical backgrounds in terms of their family history. And John Stuart Mill's father was actually a minister in the Church of Scotland until he abandoned his faith. And one of the things I try and show is that if you want to understand the emergence of, say, Marxism or let's call it... the type of racial ideologies and national socialist, fascist-like ideologies that we often associate with Nietzsche or Marxism, I think if you look at the way that these thinkers think about the world, there's a lot of assumptions made about the relationship between faith and reason. In all three cases, they basically dismiss faith as superstition, as religion is something for the weak, etc. But they can't break away from this, if you like, religious framework that is so part of the West. So you find in all these thinkers a type of yearning for a type of heaven on earth in different cases. In all three cases, I argue, it's not a particularly pleasant version of heaven, especially if you fall on the wrong side of the ideological war, the different ideological wars that these thinkers are waging. So there's a type of pseudo-religious framework at work in their thought.
Well, would you say that it takes the very powerful religious impulse, the kind of impulse that can seize a person's soul and whose entire character, but takes away from it the things that would produce out of that religion not only transcendence, but a moral good?
Yes, and
I mean, I know that's a generalization, but
no. But I think in the case of some of these thinkers that I talk about in the book, one of the things it reminds us of is that, and I say this at the beginning of one of the chapters, is that human beings are homo religiosus. We're all religious beings. Human beings by nature cannot help but ponder religious questions. Mm-hmm. Even someone who's an atheist, a professed atheist, cannot help but think about at some point in their lives, what's the ultimate meaning of life? Where do I come from? What is the meaning of what are the meanings of my choices and actions, etc.? All those are philosophical questions, but they involve at a certain level a type of religious question. So even the atheist has come to conclusions of a religious nature. They have come to some conclusions about the ultimate meaning of life, where it's all derived, and the long-term significance of my choices and acts. So this is part of the phenomena that I try to explore. When you look at some of these thinkers, in many respects, what they're producing is a type of substitute religion, and they can't, part of my argument is, they can't help but do that because they're all part of the Western tradition, which has a particular religious teleology about it. You used that word before, which I think is very important for understanding how some of these pathologies develop. But they also can't help thinking in these types of categories.
Mm-hmm.
Even someone like Nietzsche, who doesn't just reject religion, he also rejects reason, full stop. But if you look at his type of teleology, there's a type of Christ-like figure at work,
Superman
who comes down to save us, who's a strange mixture of Nordic God and Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
There's a type of endpoint to the meaning of history. There's a type of beginning. And even if you look at someone like John Stuart Mill, he can't get past the religious impulse, even though, as I point out in the book, he really does have a very anti-Christian agenda. When you look at his writings and you read some of his correspondence, he really does have a very anti-religious agenda. But it's also very clear that his version of liberalism is a type of substitute religion. It even has its own, what the Cambridge political philosopher Maurice Cowling called a type of clerisy, this sort of the intellectual as the priest who is leading people out of the darkness. So that's why I argue that these thinkers do represent pathologies of faith on the one hand, but they also represent pathologies of reason, because on the one hand, they to the certain extent, they say that reason is important, reason matters, which is a very strong theme throughout Western history. But they also radically limit its capacities. We see this in the sense of Nietzsche, who's willing to say, well, we can know certain things, but really beyond that, reason really can't tell us very much. Marx clearly understands reason in pseudo-scientific terms. Mill is the same. He talks about the epitome of reason being mathematics followed by the natural sciences, and it's very clear that philosophical questions are relegated to a second level, and even more so, religion is relegated to, at best, a third-level concern, so much so that he thought that religiously based universities such as Oxford and Cambridge in the 19th century should simply stop teaching religion full stop. But I argue that when you look at someone like Mill's thought, there's almost a type of evangelical quality to his thinking in the sense that he's preaching a new gospel, one that involves rejection of explicit claims of faith, but also a type of reduction of reason, so much so that you basically amputate reason of its ability to contemplate higher questions and reduce it to basically the natural sciences. So I think, as I said, this is, I'm not trying to present a sort of monocausal explanation of all these different problems that we've seen emerge really since beginning, I think, around about the 13th century. Then it really starts to take off in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries. But I do think it's hard to understand some of these problems unless you take what Benedict said at Regensburg about the crucial relationship between reason and faith very seriously.
Do you think that one reason Marx and Nietzsche especially, Mill somewhat, still exert a power over the beliefs and imagination of people today because of the underlying religious force of what they say?
Yes.
I mean, we have Voltaire, right? Voltaire is the irreverent figure, but he doesn't do it because Voltaire doesn't really offer an alternative religion. Right? I mean, other than just sort of anti-clerical ardor. But these others, they get under people's skin in a way, and that's part of the appeal. Not just the atheism, but the religiosity of it.
Yes, I think that's right. Because if you look at someone like Voltaire, and I talk a little bit about him, and of course his royal patron, Frederick the Great of Prussia, their view of religion is sarcastic. Both men were deists, by the way. They were not atheists, but they're clearly deists, and they clearly don't like organized religion. They don't like Christianity. If anything, they have even more distaste for Judaism. But it's a type of mocking position, and to a certain extent, they're willing to say, well, this keeps people happy, contented. It helps to civilize people to a certain extent. And people like Frederick the Great and Voltaire, Voltaire, for example, counted some Jesuits among his greatest friends. Voltaire was very happy to use the Jesuits in Prussia after they were suppressed, because with the suppression of the Jesuits in the late 18th century, because Frederick the Great thought they were wonderful educators. So there's a type of utility to religion that you find in their thought. But that's a very different thing from what you find in Marx and Nietzsche and, to a certain extent, Mill. They're about the disappearance of religion. They see religion as nothing but organized religion, or what you might call small-o orthodox religion, as nothing more than just oppressive, deeply distorting of people's minds, lives, culture, dehumanizing in effect. But they can't get out of the fact that human beings do have this natural religious impulse. And so it's inevitable that much of their way of thinking, their way of portraying the world, even the categories in which they speak, have a type of religious character that, as you said, I think your words there, gets under the skin are very important, because they do get into people's minds and hearts, so much so that there's a type of fanaticism that starts to emerge. And as I say in the book, I think that one of the reasons that you see, for example, Marxists in the 20th century willing to do whatever it takes to get to the communist paradise, to this communist utopia, or why National Socialists are willing to take sort of racial cleansing and eugenics programs to the extent that they were, is because they've got this religious impulse driving them. But of course, the problem is when you try to, what's the expression, immanentize the eschaton, it's always a disaster, because you can't realize the world envisaged by Judaism, and even more so by Christianity. By definition, you can't do it in this world. You can have intimations of it. You can construct societies that are better than others. You can try and live good lives. You can try and produce and facilitate as much human flourishing as you can, but you're never going to get, at least from the standpoint of Judaism and Christianity, you're never going to get to the heaven on earth, so to speak, because that's a contradiction. Whereas with Marxism and National Socialism and to a certain extent, I would argue modern liberalism, they're basically aping the instinct that's so deep in Western culture of Jewish and Christian faith. I mean, it's a trivial point, but if you look at someone like Marx, he looks like a Hebrew prophet from the Hebrew scriptures. He emerges almost from history proclaiming an end to injustice. He in some respects he reminds us a little bit of the language of that was used by the Hebrew prophets when they were declaiming injustice in their society. And I don't think it's a mistake that, for example, some liberation theologians saw very clear parallels between the book of Exodus and some of the writings of the Hebrew prophets and the thoughts of Karl Marx. I don't think this is coincidental. And I do think, as I try to show in my book, that this is some of the reasons why some of these particular pathologies of faith emerged and why they're so dangerous.
Let me ask about one section of the book. How does Gibbon figure in your story here?
Yes. Well, Gibbon, of course, is the master historian of the 18th century. And he, of course, wrote the famous book, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And what's interesting about that book is that it's really, in one sense, a very much a book of modern history, right? Because Gibbon took things like archaeological evidence seriously. He employed many of the techniques that we would associate with modern history today. But of course, he had a curious religious background himself. When he was at Oxford, he converted to Catholicism. His father sent him abroad to get this Catholicism out of him because he saw it would be a big impediment to social progress in England at the time. He reconverts back to a form of Protestantism, but basically he's a skeptic. That's very clear. But his argument, in which brought him notoriety, of course, at the time, was that if you wanted to understand the fall of the Roman Empire, there were many causes, but maybe the main cause was the rise of Christianity. And he said that Christianity made society effeminate. It turned it into a society that was inclined to pacifism. It destroyed a sense of loyalty to the civic virtues of the empire. He famously said it distracted people, emperors and senators, from thinking about how do we defend the empire, and instead getting them focused and immersed on doctrinal disputes among Christians, etc. He doesn't have very much time for the Jews either. He basically describes the Jews as this very stubborn people who persist in the ancestral ways that are clearly so irrational, and how could they possibly be like that? And weren't the Romans basically these very tolerant people, etc.? And one of the things I say is that Gibbon's tale, if you like, Gibbon's analysis of the fall of the Roman Empire, and particularly the role played by Judaism and Christianity in that, I think is fundamentally misconstrued and wrong. And I argue it's wrong because I say that to dismiss, for example, to dismiss the Jews as this sort of highly tribalistic, closed-minded people simply doesn't account for the fact that it's really the Hebrew prophets, centuries before the Greeks, who arrive at this vision of the Creator as obviously divine, monolithic, just, sometimes hard to understand, but definitely rational, that this is not an irrational God. And that's very different from the pagan world, which had this was populated by a religion that held there's lots of different gods. They are whole selfish, self-obsessed creatures who are doing all sorts of terrible things to each other and to human beings. And Judaism challenges that very, very directly. And we see in the Greek world at the same time, they're starting to come to some similar conclusions about the nature of religion and the nature of God, but they can't quite get there. In fact, they never quite get there. They never get anywhere close, except maybe in some of the writings of Plato's and Socrates and Aristotle. They never really get as close as the Jews do to this particular understanding of the nature of God. And we see this starting to come together in the idea of logos. And none of this, of course, is to be found in the work of Gibbon. He doesn't talk about this. He doesn't talk about the fact that by the first century before Christ, this idea of logos, which is a Greek word which meant many things, but it really meant for both Jews and Christians by about 50 BC, BCE, the idea that God is love, he's divine justice, but he's also logos. He is divine reason itself. And that is very important because I think it made sense to many Greeks and many Romans, for example, because the conclusions that they were starting to arrive at when it comes to the natural sciences, when it comes to some philosophical questions, clearly were irreconcilable with the pagan view of religion and what religion meant in a pagan sense, because you couldn't reconcile elementary physics with the idea of Zeus and Venus and Jupiter and, the panoply, the whole group of Greek and Roman gods and the way that they influenced people's understanding of the world. Whereas Judaism and Christianity, with its particular understanding of God clarified through the Greek language of logos, really makes a decisive difference. So much so that I would argue that, if anything, Christianity prolonged the existence of the Roman Empire, much more so than continued adherence to the pagan gods have. But it's important to talk about Gibbon because, not for just all those reasons, but because towards the end of the 18th century, this is the turn that a lot of Enlightenment thinking had taken, because Gibbon is clearly an Enlightenment figure. He's using a lot of Enlightenment language. And at this point in history, particularly in continental Europe, different forms of Enlightenment are starting to take on a decidedly anti-Christian dimension. And Gibbon reflects a lot of that.
Well, let me ask one thing. Is this, as you put it, belief in a good and ordered world, is that one of the essential ingredients of Western civilization? I mean, which doesn't deny the presence of various forms of irrationality
Of course. And dark spots, right? Dark spots in Western history. And I say that there's no question that there are many dark spots in the history of the West, ranging from slavery, very long-term problem, to something like, I think, the single event, which I think did so much damage to the very idea that there is this thing called Western civilization, which I say, I think the Holocaust, because this, of course, was perpetrated by some, in many cases, very well-educated people from a country and a culture that prided itself on its rationality and its highly sophisticated university system and general cultural ethos. So I say all that. But I also say that if you want to understand the West's emphasis upon this idea of human flourishing, which we often talk about today, but I think the phrase freedom for excellence is maybe a better way of talking about it. A good society is one in which people have the freedom in order to be able to pursue this higher form of excellence, this participation in the goods that make us distinctly human, the virtues that represent a type of improvement of who we already are along the ways that we're supposed to be. And I argue that obviously other cultures, other civilizations have touched on this. They've produced things that, in some respects, approximations of this idea of the West of a good as a good and ordered and free and just and creative and reasonable society. But no one, I don't think it re any other society or culture really gets as close as the West has at different points to presenting this as an ideal. Because when I talk about the Western civilization, I don't literally mean it's confined to geographical reasons. And I make that regions of the world, I say that right at the very beginning. It's a set of ideas that theoretically anyone can buy into. And in that sense, the West has truly universalistic implications.
Let's finish off with your conclusion. Is the West over?
Yes, I knew people would ask me that question when I was writing the book, and it's the obvious question, right? Because when you read many books about Western society, Western culture, Western civilization today, it seems to me they break down into two categories. One are those books that say the West is fundamentally corrupt, it's bad, it's evil, it was bad from the beginning, it's characterized by slavery, oppression. Christianity either made things worse or better, depending, but really it's not that significant in the long term. Basically, we have to get rid of the whole thing and move on to something different because it's fundamentally oppressive. Or there are those books who say, well, Western civilization was, note I use the phrase in the past tense, was a great endeavor, but basically it's dead. And my argument is that neither of those positions are satisfactory because one, as I try to show in the book, I don't think Western civilization is fundamentally flawed. I think it's essentially good, essentially something that if more and more people learnt about and embraced and lived, we would all live better lives and we would all live in better societies. But I also don't think that it's doomed. And the reason I say that is because if the West is capable of getting the relationship between reason and faith right, if it does that, if it's capable of doing that, then lots of good things should naturally flow from that. So, for example, I say, well, what's an example of that? And I say, well, in certain respects, you can look at the American founding as somewhat of an example of this. Now, there's also obviously problematic aspects of the American founding. We all know that. But it's interesting, and I talk about this in the last chapter, the way that the American founding dealt with the whole question of reason and faith, of rationality and religion, I try and argue was essentially in a positive way. And by the way, Joseph Ratzinger says the same thing. He says that if you look at what he calls the two great revolutions of the Enlightenment, he's very favorably disposed to what he calls the Anglo-American version as opposed to what he calls the French version. Now, and I use this as an example, the American founding and the late 18th century America and early 19th century America as an example where this relationship between reason and religion was relatively harmonious. And I think that, for example, the prevalence of natural law thinking that was very widespread in American universities and colleges at the time has a lot to do with it. I think it's also the case that in the early American Republic, you had many ministers of religion, overwhelmingly Protestant, of course, who took Enlightenment thinking and reasoning seriously, but were engaged in a type of critical engagement with it. They didn't reject it holus bolus, and they saw much good in it, but they also were willing to point out the flaws. And I think a society that is capable of developing that type of direction tells us that we can overcome some of these pathologies of reason and religion if we are very clear about how these things emerge and the good and the real civilizational fruit that emerges when reason and faith, rationality and religion are integrated in the right way. And I often say to people, the thing to keep in mind is that Judaism and even more so Christianity has always taken reason very, very seriously. And I think if it's the case that more religious believers do start to talk about this idea of God as logos, as God as a rational creator, and what that means for people who Jews and Christians believe are made in the very image of God, then that type of anthropological revolution in the way that we understand ourselves has enormous capacity to change our civilization in a way just as the Jews and the early Christians radically transformed Roman civilization, which for all its high points and strengths was fundamentally flawed because of the pagan religions that dominated their religious outlook. So I'm relatively hopeful because I don't think it's easy for people to escape this question of the relationship between reason and faith, and that the more we discuss it, the more obvious it becomes that a healthy integration of reason and faith is central to the very identity of the West. And that reintegrating reason and faith along the lines that we have some intimations of in the past has every potential to deal in a relatively decisive way with some of the pathologies that really caused the West to become undone throughout much of the 20th century.
Thank you, Samuel Gregg. The book is Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. We'll look forward to having you again next year.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and thank you for having me on First Things Podcast.